Hello there, this is me, Matt Smith, welcoming you, the listener, to another La Trobe University podcast. Quite a good interview for you today, as I'm joined by a guest who travels to far-flung places and listens to what people say. His name is Dr. Stephen Marie, and he's from the Research Centre for Language Diversity. He's all about preserving languages.
Well, basically, I'm making recordings of and analysing the recordings I make of various languages. Well, in India, they're generally termed tribal languages, of small communities that live in the part of India that closely borders Burma. So in the state of Assam and the neighbouring state of Arunachal Pradesh, but particularly in Assam, there are a number of communities who, over the last 1,000 years, some quite recently, some quite a long time ago, have come over into India from Southeast Asia. And they speak a wide range of languages, and most of them haven't been recorded or studied before in that kind of tradition of linguistics that I belong to.
Why is it important then to catalogue those languages?
Well, it's a good question. It's important for those communities themselves because they are relatively poor communities who don't have and haven't had until now any resources for recording their own culture. And because they're small communities, they're under pressure to change their language to the state language or the national language, to standardise that and turn it into one thing. A lot of linguistic diversity that's in danger of being lost. For the wider world, I think it's important because the way in which language has evolved into the very substantial diversity we have right now tells us something about the way that humanity operates, and particularly the way that the brain and language operates. And we can learn about language in a more general sense by studying this diversity. But we can't do that unless we have record of the different types of ways in which languages work. Perhaps even more importantly, the things that languages don't do, because maybe that's something that human cognition also doesn't do. And I think that diversity of language and diversity of culture is a bit like biodiversity. On the face of it, you'd think, well, what does it matter if 200 of Australia's small mammals are extinct? But actually, I think we all now recognise that it does matter because it's part of a bigger picture. We're losing information, we're losing cultural heritage without even knowing what it is.
So when you say that these communities are under pressure to change their languages, it's not an intentional pressure always.
Those members of the communities who can afford it will send their children off to schools. Now, there are local schools, of course, but the children want to be educated at higher education. They can't be educated in their own language. And so at the very time of life when in traditional society, the cleverer young people would be learning the traditions of that community, would be learning the stories, learning the songs, learning the cultural practices, they're off somewhere else, studying maths or science or engineering or whatever, and that's of course all good, but in a different language, either in English, which is widely used in India, or in Assamese, which is the language of the state, or in Hindi, which is the first national language together with English. In order to be educated, in order to live in the modern society and have a good job and so on, being able to speak the Tulim variety of Tangsa won't help you. And people understand that, so they want to do that. Of course, it isn't necessary to give up being a Tulim Tangsa speaker in order to be an English speaker. You can do both. But it's very hard for the young people who are sent away from home, often at a very young age, to boarding schools to keep their language skills up.
Can you tell me some specifics about your job? What projects have you been working on specifically?
I started as a PhD student, I was at Monash then, working on Thai languages. I've had several postdoctoral fellowships here at La Trobe and I've been working on languages that belong to a family called Tibeto-Burman, the two most famous languages in it being Tibetan and Burmese. None of the languages I work on can be understood by Tibetan or Burmese speakers, but there's some common ground between them. They all have a word, something like lam, L-A-M, meaning a road. It's a typical feature of all of those languages. So basically, the work involves going to the villages where these languages are spoken and, if possible, learning to speak it myself. But there's so many different varieties there that I can't learn them all. So I do the best I can in the time I have available, recording essentially anything that people want to talk about. But generally what people want to do is to sing traditional songs, tell traditional stories, or talk about traditional cultural information, like the festivals they used to hold or how they would go about preparing the rice fields for farming. So generally people tell you about those things, and what I do is then essentially play back those recordings and find out what was on them. So I generally don't understand them all first time. And so I get someone from the village who has a language in common with me to help me make a translation of it. And that way we both preserve the meaning of those things, and at the same time I'm getting some data with which I can make a study of the structure of the language, how it works, how different bits fall together. And these are languages which, for example, put the verb at the end. So they wouldn't say something like the tiger chased the deer. They would say something like the tiger the deer chased. And they wouldn't have a the in there either, probably. So it would come out somewhat differently from English.
How much do you find is lost in the translation then between those?
That's hard for me to say, because if it's lost in the translation, then it's probably lost to me as well. Because what we do is we identify the meaningful bits of the language, which can be whole words or parts of words. In English, if you have a word like cat, cat is a whole word with a single meaning. But if you make it into cats, plural, then the s bit means plural. So that's got two meaningful bits in it, but it's one word. Some languages combine like that, and others keep the words separated. So if you put a thing that means plural, you have a separate word to do that. Anyway, so basically what we do is take the meaningful units and what we technically call gloss, write down the meaning in English for each of the individual bits. Then the overall meaning comes from that. So once you understand what the individual bits mean and how they work together, then you can turn it into a meaningful English sentence. Sometimes that's very hard, because people might put things in a different order, and so you have to put words in which are not in the original. Suppose I said, once upon a time there was a tiger and it was walking in the forest. In most of the languages I work with, you don't need this it. You'd say, once upon a time, tiger was, forest walk. Something like that. It is understood that you're referring back to the tiger. So we have to put words in that aren't in the original, and sometimes we have to take words out because they have some other meaning. So in that sense, I guess that's loss. Another thing that might get lost are deeper meanings. So I've spent a lot of time recording traditional songs. And the traditional songs, you can, with some difficulty, work out what each individual word means, or each individual meaningful part means. The words might mean one thing, but there are other meanings attached to it, because it's part of a song that belonged to some ritual, or it was a love song or something. So there's hidden meanings underneath, and it takes a long time to work out what they are. So if you're singing a love song and acting the part of the boy, you say something like, "My rice granary is overflowing to the extent that I can't push it over with my legs." I have a song that says exactly that.
I'm going to have to censor this podcast if you translate that, aren't I?
Well, possibly. At one level, it means exactly what it says. It's nicely poetic and it sounds good. At another level, it means I'm a rich man. I have got a lot of things, and therefore you, young lady that I like, if you come and be with me, you'll be fine. At yet another level, it might mean something quite sexual, which I couldn't even speculate on. But I know, for example, that it has the first two meanings. I also know that when we translate these songs, because it's only the old people who know them, that they laugh a lot when we get to some of these bits. And they have never quite explained what that means. In one case, they did tell me that love songs would never be sung at home. Because at home, the people that are there are you and your sisters, and you can't sing love songs to them. I've heard stories of people would go out into the forest. They would know there was someone not very far away, so that maybe the boy or the girl would start singing something like this, and then the other one would respond back. And there you can do it, because maybe that girl belongs to a different family and she isn't your sister, so you can sing it to her. So yeah, there are some issues there.
You've done some work as well with languages that no one speaks anymore, is that true?
Yes, there's a few of those. When you're working on languages that are no longer spoken, you're working with usually written materials that have either been written by the people themselves or have been written by other people. And I do a bit of both. One of the groups I work with in Northeast India, a group called the Tayahom, they had a substantial tradition of manuscripts, of which there are still thousands stored in villages all over the northeast of India. And translating those is difficult because nobody speaks that as a spoken language anymore. There are similar related languages, and I've got a person from Thailand who has expertise in Thai literature. They are Hom is related to the language of Thailand. We work on the translation of these. It's a slow process, but we are gradually getting through it. Part of the problem is that the script was not devised for that language. They borrowed an alphabet from another language, and the language they borrowed it from didn't have tones. Tones means you have different meanings according to the tune of a word. So I can give an example from the spoken language. In Thai Pake, you have na, 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 and all of these have different meanings.
Wow.
The first one means to quarrel, the second one means a paddy field, the third one means your face, the fourth one means the mother's sister, younger sister, the fifth one means to melt away, I think. And the sixth one means to be thick, as in the opposite of thin or narrow. They don't sound the same, but you might not have picked up the differences on the first hearing. And these all have different meanings, but they are written in the same way. So that's six different meanings for one word. If you've got a four-word sentence, then that's a lot of possible meanings. Now, of course, most of those meanings would be nonsense, but there can often be several different ways of interpreting the marks on the page, and that just takes time. We're currently working on a manuscript that's 60 pages long. That's 60 double-sided sheets of bark with ink writing on it, and about 2,500 lines of text. We find that something that we saw on page 10, the same words reoccur when we get to page 35. By page 35, we've worked out what it means, so we have to go back to page 10 and correct the translation there as well. Mm. That's a slow process.
This manuscript that you're working on,
yep.
Do you have an inkling on what it's about?
Actually, that was reasonably clear from the start, because the owner of the manuscript, who has preserved it very nicely for a long period, it having been handed down from father to son, it's several hundred years old, he knows in general what it's about. It's actually a Buddhist story of one of the former lives of the Buddha. There are hundreds and hundreds of these stories, and it's not the one we expected it to be. That much we know by now. Basically, the story is of a prince and the lady that he falls in love with. And then, because his mind is not properly developed, he abandons this lady in a forest. And then it talks about how he suffers the consequences of that. It's the idea of karma. So it's a typical Buddhist story. And we've got to the point now where the two of them are reunited after being separated for a long time. Because he abandoned her. And then he got lost and he got imprisoned. He was enslaved for a time. And he's got out of that. And now he's back together with her. We're just waiting to find out what happens next. I think his mind gets developed as a result of this, and in his next life he'll behave better. But we've also done manuscripts which are ritual texts, the text that you read when there's a problem in the country and you need to call back the spirit of the country. So we've done that manuscript. We've got different versions of this manuscript, but up until now none have been translated. But I heard recently that they have recently performed this ceremony again in Northeast India after a considerable period, and I want to find out more, but I think they may have used, at least in part, the translation that we made to assist with that process, because earlier did not have a translation of this.
So that's maybe an example of your work being put to new good use.
Yeah, I think the thing with this kind of work is that it doesn't produce instant results. I'll give you an example of the importance of recording things. There was a scholar from Thailand who died 20 years ago, who went to Northeast India, to the area where I'm working, 50 years ago, and made recordings. About 10 or 12 years ago, I got in touch with her niece and found out that there were some recordings still surviving in the form of tapes, and borrowed those from her and got them digitized here in Australia. Took them back to India and played them in the village where they'd been recorded. And there were two really nice things that happened as a result of that. The first was, when I started playing them, the lady of the house, who's now 70, and her third son was sitting there. And the third son had never been much interested in the work I was doing. And after the recording started, there was an old man singing some songs. He got up and went out. And I thought, well, he's just not interested in these old songs. But I was wrong. 5 minutes later, I heard someone running up the steps. And the boy who'd gone out had gone to collect one of his friends, because the person on the tape was this boy's father, this young man's father. And that father had died when this young man was only 1 year old. So he had never heard his father's voice. And you can't imagine what it's like. Well, I can't imagine what it would be like to run up the stairs and there's a recording of your father singing, playing, and you have never heard his voice before. So that was one thing. But in addition to that, this community, when they heard these recordings, because they'd had up to that point no recordings at all of their traditional songs, they immediately said, well, these are really good examples of how to sing properly. So everybody asked me, can I make copies of this? Can you make copies of this? Can you make copies of this? And they play them sometimes, and I've heard this happen, even some years later, played them at their festivals as an example to the young people of how you sing properly. They can now listen back to those and say, this is a good way of singing this particular song. So they were recordings not made by me, but made by somebody long back, of somebody who's passed away. But I know somehow that in 20, 30 years' time, the recordings that I have made will be as valuable as that. Because once the present generation of old people have passed away, still their words will be preserved.
That was Dr. Stephen Marie, and you can listen to a talk he gave on Thai Ahom translations in the Language Diversity Collection of La Trobe University on iTunes U. That's it for today for the La Trobe University podcast. If you'd like to send us an email for any reason, even if it is just to say hi, then you can reach us at podcast@latrobe.edu.au.